Good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming out for week two of our four-part series. This week we have Resorting to Secular Courts. Next week is The Ethics of Rent Control. Welcome, Steve. That had nothing to do with rent control. And then the fourth week will be by Rabbi Baruch Weintraub, our Sigan, my deputy Rosh Beit Midrash with the Yeshiva University Talmid Tzion Beit Midrash. I'm grateful to three articles in particular for starting points for my work on this topic, because there's so much literature out there. It was good to be able to focus a little bit using three articles in particular. One is by Rabbi Simcha Kraus in the second edition, the second volume of the journal known as the RJJ Journal, Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society, and I'll be quoting that a little bit later. The second one by Rabbi Michael Broyd in his book, The Pursuit of Justice in Jewish Law. And then the third, an online article by Rabbi Ari Marburger from an organization in Lakewood called Beis Havad, which sends out weekly emails in business law and business ethics. And frankly, it's a good read and worthwhile. So there's a lot to talk about. Frankly, we really could have done all of my 3 weeks, certainly, on the issue of litigating in secular courts. There's so much to address. I'm going to try to focus on two key pieces. Number one is why we have this tradition of not resorting to secular courts, and I'll explain the question as well as answers when we get to that. And then second, what if you're stuck because the other litigant isn't interested in going to Beit Din, isn't interested in going to a Jewish court? Whether the other litigant is Jewish or non-Jewish, now what do you do when you're trying to be a good boy and saying, I'm going to go to Jewish courts, and the other litigant is entirely uninterested? So those are the two main questions I'd like to address today over the next 40 minutes or so. I don't know if it's possible to get some more chairs, but I think there's a group of people who actually told me they're planning on being here, a group of three people. I don't know if we can
organize them.
Yeah, because they're not here yet, but I'm sure they're on their way. Thank you. So, number one, the prohibition against litigating in secular court. If you take a look at source number one, passage from the Talmud, a quote from Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Tarfon, we're talking now first century Common Era. So, Hay Rabbi Tarfon Omer, Rabbi Tarfon used to say, Kol makom sh'ata motze aguriyot shel ovdei kochavim, wherever you find the courts of idolaters, even if their system of judgment is like ours, they're going to come to the same conclusions that we do. You are not allowed to turn to them. You can't resort to them for your litigation. Shneamar, because the pasuk says, these are the laws, God says to Moshe, to Moses. These are the laws you are going to place before them. So who is them? Lifnehem, before the Jewish people, velo lifnei ovdei kochavim, and not before idolaters. Davar acher, or alternatively, lifnehem, velo lifnei idiotos, before them, the judges, and not before regular people, meaning you need trained judges. So we have two requirements here. Number one, we're told your judges should be Jews. And number two, we are told that your judges should be regular people. The speech, the address that Moshe gives the nation is, you shall place your judgments in front of Jews who are trained. That's the source for this in the Talmud. Now, we have to come back to this source because there's more to understand here. This is not as simple and straightforward as I just made it out to be. But take a look, please, at source number two, which is where the Rambam, Maimonides, codifies this as law. And his language is extremely strong. He says, Kol hadon b'dayane akum ube'erkaot shelahem. Anyone who judges with idolater judges or with their courts. Notice the distinction. Non-Jewish judges, non-Jewish courts. Why does he need to spell out both? Oh, come on. Why does he need to spell
Jewish
out both? Because you can have a Jewish judge in a non-Jewish court. Right?
Is this an adult,
judge that is idolatrous, not necessarily...
Correct. I'm going to come back to that question. Good point. Whether idolater means idolater, or does idolater mean someone who isn't Jewish? And then the other question is, what if it is a non-Jewish arbitrator? Not a non-Jewish court, but simply a non-Jew you go to and you say, please arbitrate, please handle our case. So we have to deal with that as well. So the Rambam writes, you can't go before non-Jewish or before idolatrous, to keep Dori's word. The idolatrous judges or their court system, Aval Pisha Hayudinem Kidine Yisrael, even where their laws are the same as ours, even where their conclusion will be identical to our own, as we already saw in source number one. He says, somebody who does that, Hareze Rasha, a person who does that is wicked. It is as though he had blasphemed and scorned the Torah, it appears. Veherim yad v'taras Moshe Rabbeinu, and he has raised a hand against the Torah of Moshe our master. Shenamar, and he quotes Psukim, he quotes passages from the Torah to that effect. And then he continues. Well, you know, before he continues, actually, his language is a lot stronger than Rabbi Tarfon's language. Right? I think that's safe to say. We're going to get to the second half of the sentence a little bit later. I'm not ready for that yet. But that's his codification, and it is brought in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, the section called Kosher and Mishpat that deals with financial issues, chapter 26. So, why is the Rambam so exercised by this? Why is this such a big deal that he's willing to say, Rabbi Tarfon just said you're not supposed to do it, the Torah says put your laws, put your judgments before Jewish judges. The Rambam has a much stronger formulation. What's the reason?
800 years.
I'm sorry?
800 years.
Of?
The government, the different element. Mm-hmm. One time you had Jewish courts. Rabbi Tarfon's time.
Yes.
You go to Romans, were there. Still had Jewish courts.
Correct.
There, and afterwards you had nothing but whatever you had to pick up on.
Right. So in other words, your argument is, and I want to make sure the sheet goes around, so did it? Oh, I see. There's more than one? Okay. Your argument is the Rambam statement is a function of history.
Right.
It's a function of the time in which he lives. Could be. He's certainly a lot stronger. Let me ask the question a little bit differently. Instead of asking you about the contrast between the Rambam's formulation and the Talmud's formulation, what is it that is so upsetting about going to a non-Jewish court? Why is this such a bad thing to do that the Rambam says you are raising your hand against the Torah of Moshe?
Denies Das Torah.
Why?
Whether the conclusion is the same in a secular court or a Jewish court, it's very possible that the reasoning is very different,
mm-hmm.
and that it is, and that you can't anticipate what that answer would be.
Right. So in other words, the point isn't the conclusion of the court case. The point is, in fact, the Torah's thought process that gets you there.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's a denial of, you know, rabbinic thought.
Could be. Stan?
Well, I'm just saying that the Jewish law isn't as valid as it's validating Jewish law publicly.
Right. It's a rejection.
Yeah.
I mean, when he says you raised a hand against the Torah of Moshe, it's a rejection of our Torah. But let me turn the case a little bit. Take a look, please, at source number 3. This is probably a familiar source. We know that there are 7 mitzvot b'nei Noach, 7, as we call them, Noahide laws. In fact, the term Noahide law is a misnomer, because 6 of them are addressed, we are taught in the Gemara, to Adam and Chava, to Adam and Eve. And only the 7th is added to Noach. The 7th being Abram and Achai, not to eat from anything that was taken from an animal while the animal was alive. That's the 7th. But all the other ones, not to kill, not to steal, not to worship idols, these all go back to Adam and Eve, and the Gemara traces them to a sentence in which God addresses Adam. And that's what I want you to see here in source number 3. Vayitzav, the sentence in which God speaks to Adam, begins with, and God instructed, God commanded. And that's a strong term, and the Gemara says it's a technical term. Vayitzav, elu hadinin. The word vayitzav doesn't just mean God instructs Adam, don't eat from the tree, which in fact is what he's going to say in the sentence, but it actually means, keep tzavaot, keep this sort of command, this breed of command, which is a law, you should have all sorts of laws, what we call civil law. Elu adinin. Vayitzav teaches, God says to Adam, you should have a system of civil law. V'cheinu omer, and so it says later on in the Torah, before God informs Abraham about his desire to destroy the city of Sodom, he says, Ki idativ, I love Abraham. L'man asher yitzaves banav, he's going to instruct his children, lasot tzedakah u'mishpat, to perform righteousness and justice. So that, the source number 3 says, that the non-Jews of the world are instructed as one of the mitzvot b'nei Noach, one of the Noahide laws, that they should set up a system of law. Well, how does it look when you tell the nations, set up a system of law, but by the way, you Jews, if you actually dare take a case to those courts, you know, you are blaspheming and raising a hand against God and so on. It doesn't look right. No? For you to say that, for you to say that that they should set up a system of law, but Jews, you shouldn't actually use it. It's beneath you. That's a very hard thing to say. That's number one. Number two, take a look at the next source. Source number 4. A classic. Omar Shmuel, the sage, makes the statement, Dina de Malchuta Dina. The law of the land is the law. The law of the kingdom is the law. The context in which this statement is brought is an interesting discussion in its own right regarding tax collection, where they discuss the status of the tax collectors, the Roman tax collectors. It looks like they don't recognize them as legally binding, that you would be allowed even to evade their collection. And as Talmud challenges that and says, what do you mean? The law of the land is the law. And their answer is, this isn't really talking about government tax collection. It's talking about the old practice that they had of selling the rights to tax collection to private individuals, privatizing tax collection, and then the private individuals would do whatever they wanted and charge this one this amount and that one that amount, whatever they chose. And that was the system that was not respected. But the law of the land, when the government says, it goes. So now you're telling me, number one, that we instruct the nations to set up courts. And number two, you're also telling me that we respect their laws. So why is this off limits now? Why am I not to use their courts? So one answer, and Stan's answer stands, as well as David's answer, I think stands. David's answer was that there's inherent value in the way the Torah hears a case. And you're going to miss that if you go to some other court, even if the conclusion is different.
Yes, Beit Din has the right to take into account the law of the land.
Correct.
As it makes its decision.
Correct. Not just the right, in many cases the obligation.
That's right.
Right? If you remember our discussion last week when we talked about eavesdropping, right? So we talked about, we brought several authorities who said, where there are secular laws against it, we pile that on to the list of prohibitions that are violated when one intentionally listens to somebody else's conversation. So we absolutely do take it into account. But what I want to get to in this part are three ideas. The first idea for why we're not supposed to use a secular court is very straightforward. I think it's really what Stan said. But take a look at source number 5 because Rashi said it too. And while I like Stan very much, I also like Rashi. The Rashi in source number 5 commenting on that sentence in the book of Shemot of Exodus, which we quoted in source number 1, Rashi says the following, Al tvi'ehu be'erkaot shalahem, do not bring your case before their courts. Shamevi dinei Yisrael lefnei goyim, because someone who brings Jewish decisions, Jewish issues, in front of goyim, in front of the nations, note that he doesn't use the word akum, he's using the word goyim, before the nations, mechalel et Hashem, desecrates the name, capital N, the name of God, umiyaker shem avodazara lachshiva, and he honors idolatry by giving it importance.
What's the idolatry?
Good question. Did you see the switch? Right? Rashi switched. In the beginning, it was goyim, nations in general. Now he says, you give honor to idolatry by going to their courts. It is not clear from Rashi's language as to whether this is about idolatry or whether it's about the nations. Frankly, from his closing, it sounds like it's an idolatry concern. Yes?
question.
Yeah.
It's idolatry. Let's say a Jew is going to sue another Jew.
Yeah.
And very often, 95% cases, nothing gets a court, is a settlement.
Right.
And also, 70% cases, you've got a Jewish law, especially in this area.
Yeah.
Can you really call that idolatry?
You mean doing the settlement?
Yes.
So I'm going to come back to the settlement question. It's a good one. But Rashi's statement, if I don't say it explicitly, please remind me, but there's a point where I wanted to get to that. Rashi's statement is, I think, along the lines of what Stan said, it's chilul Hashem, you're desecrating God's name by saying, I'm not going to go to a Jewish court. And it strengthens this other system, which Rashi calls idolatry. Now, to make a long story short, the halakhic authorities do say it applies to secular courts as well. And that can be seen in various sources. They do not assume that this is solely about idolatry. But that's my first concern. Is you make our courts look bad, you look like you're rejecting the Jewish system by going elsewhere, by going outside the community. That's one. A second concern, I'm flipping the order of some of my sources on the sheet, so please stick with me. The second concern is in source number 8, and Rabbi Simcha Krauss, in the article I mentioned in the beginning, is the one who floats this idea. This is a response from Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, also known as Rashba, good, in Spain in the 13th century. And he is dealing with a particular case of a family's inheritance. I think the case was where a man married off his daughter and he gave her a large dowry. And she died shortly after the wedding. And he wanted the dowry back. He didn't want it to go to the son-in-law. And he wanted to litigate in secular court to be able to get it back. That's the background on this case, because there was, in fact, a local practice that in such a case, God forbid, the dowry would go back to the deceased bride's family. So that's where he's coming from.
Local civil practice?
Local civil practice, correct. So he writes, you can see the Hebrews on one side, the English is on the other side. Lilmo, he said, he's responding to someone who said, well, after all, the law of the land is the law. So he says, Lilmo de Mizeh, to deduce from there, from the statement that the law of the land is binding, Lelech bedarchei hagoyim umishpateihem chas v'shalom, to God forbid, use the ways of the nations and their laws, la'am kadosh, for a holy nation, lino kacha, to conduct itself in this way. He goes on with more rhetoric about that, and he says, V'kolshkein, and certainly, im atayo sifu lachto, lakor nachlata abal abanim, if now they're going to increase their sins, they're going to uproot the inheritance of, or the property of, a father upon the children, v'somecha mishenet kana ratzutz hazeh, they're depending on this fragile, slender, broken reed for their support, this idea of the law of the land, that's their basis for litigating this in secular court, v'osei elema pilchamot ha-Torah, one who would do this would knock down the walls of Torah, v'oker shorish v'anav, he would uproot root and branch, v'atara miyado tevakesh, and the Torah will demand from him justice, u'marbeho no bazeh b'po'a kapav nokesh, and someone who will increase his wealth through this will stumble as a result of his own deeds. Obviously, he's not happy. But there's also the way the Rashba wrote. You have to read the Rashba more, and you'll see this is his style. Va'omer ani, I say, shekola somech bazeh lomar shemutar mishum dina demalchuta to'ev v'gazlanhu. One who depends on this, well, after all, the law of the land is the law, is making a mistake and is a thief. That's his position on it. And then he continues to say, Ubichlal, oker kol dinei ha-Torah ha-shlema. In general, he says, with this type of a thing, he says, he's uprooting the laws of the complete Torah. Uma lanu lisifrei hakodesh hamekudashim shechibru lanu Rabbi Acha Rabbi Vachor Ravina Rav Ashi. He says, if you believe that, if you believe you can go to a secular court to adjudicate for Jews, then why do I need the holy books put together by Rabbi, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi? He means the Mishnah. And Ravina and Rav Ashi, who are the compilers of the Gemara, he says, then who needs the Talmud? You know how much of the Talmud is occupied by civil law? He says, who needs it? You can just go to the secular courts. Yilamdu as b'neihem dinei hagoyim. Teach that. Let them teach their kids the laws of the nations. V'yivnu lehem b'mos t'luos b'beis midrisei hagoyim. I wasn't sure if this was an intentional pun or not. He said, let them build patchwork altars. That's a quote from Yechezkel. But he said, let them build patchwork altars in Beit Midrasei Hagoyim. So I didn't know if that was meant to be like Beit Midrash. And madrasa, possibly, if he's living among Muslims and Arabic speakers. Or whether it was midras as a form of impurity. When someone who is impure with certain types of impurity walks upon something, he communicates to Mag Midras impurity. So therefore, maybe it may have been a pun. Beit Midrasei, their study halls and the place of impurity. But he says, what do you need Torah for? In that case, go off to them. Chalila lo tia kazos bi Yisrael chas v'shalom. He says, God forbid, there should never be anything like this. Shema tachor haTorah ale hasak. The Torah would wear sackcloth if such a thing were to happen. What is he concerned about? It's stronger than the concern for a making us look bad. He's concerned about something else.
He doesn't mean madrasa. Madrasa is the Arabic term for school.
Right, you have to know Rashba. Rashba is filled with puns. And so I think he's actually doing a pun here with it. Yeah, I actually suspect he intends a pun. But in any case, that's neither here nor there for us. What is he doing beyond what we said so far? Beyond the concern of making the Torah look bad, he's worried about a second step, which is, if you resort to secular courts, people aren't going to learn Torah anymore. Why should I bother becoming an expert in civil law as recorded by the Torah? There's no point. And if you'll say, well, people will learn it because, after all, it's Torah and we learn Torah, you don't learn something the same way when you're learning it in an abstract sense as when you are learning it and you have to give practical answers. It's an entirely different way of doing things. When you're going to have to adjudicate cases, and you have angry litigants standing in front of you, and one saying this, and one saying that, and you need to find a resolution that's consistent with the laws of the Torah, you look at it very differently. You don't look at it the same way as you did when you were sitting in yeshiva across the table from your chavrusa, and you were studying Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra. It doesn't look the same. So he says, and this is Rabbi Krauss's point, a second concern is that you're going to nullify, really, the practical study of much of Torah if you're going to go this route. They didn't intend that, or they wouldn't have bothered to write it all down this way. And so that's a second argument. And then there's a third argument, which I think is potent in its own right, and very significant for us, and that is justice in Judaism is not only a civil concept. Justice in Judaism is not only the way we resolve fights between individuals. So I want to build an extension on my house. You're complaining because you think I'm over the line or because I can see into your property. Okay, let's go to the court and the court is going to resolve it. That's not the sum of what we do. From the perspective that the Torah gives us, justice is actually a function of religious life. It's a way that the Jew relates to God. And perhaps the greatest proof is the way it's first presented in the Torah. That biblical sentence, these are the laws that you shall present before them. That appears in the Torah right after what? What comes right before that in the Torah? Right. In Parashat Yitro, the 20th chapter in Shemot in Exodus, we have the Jews standing at Sinai, receiving the Ten Commandments, then following down, we get laws about building an altar and how to worship God, and then we get, here are the laws for your civil courts. Going from one to the next teaches me that these laws about civil courts are not only about how you resolve fights between people. These are religious as well. And that emerges within the sources that I'm gonna bring right now. First of all, just worth noting, the High Court, the Supreme Court, is called the Sanhedrin. Where did that court convene?
Which point of time?
No, it is a central location where it was supposed to be before they got evicted. Not just Yerushalayim. The Shkat HaGazit, they sat in the room in the Beis Hamikdash, in the temple itself. That's where they convened. They convened in the Beis HaMikdash, the chamber of hewn stone, Lishkat HaGazit. That's where they meet. What greater display can you have of the fact that this is viewed as a religious destination? It's sitting there in the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara at the beginning of Brachot says that Hashem sits with every Beit Din of three judges when they convene. The Karev Elohim Yishpot is a reference, Elohim is a reference to the judges, not to God, but God is there when they are there. If you take a look, I brought you in source number 6. Those who do Daf Yomi saw this just a couple of weeks ago. Kol Dayan Shadan Din Emet La'amito Afilu Sha'a Achad. Any judge who judges truthfully. The phrase Emet La'amito is worthy of its own discussion. What is Emet La'amito? Truth in its true form. That's a great discussion, but not for right now. Any judge who judges honestly, Afilu Sha'a Achad, even for a moment. The Torah considers it as though he was a partner with God in the deeds of creation. The Gemara gets that from Moshe. When Moshe judges the nation, it says, Min habokir ad ha'arev, from morning to evening. And when the Torah describes creation, it says, Vayi erev, vayi boker. So the Gemara links the two, the morning and evening reference of creation and the morning and evening reference of Moshe, to say a judge who judges honestly is like a partner of God in creation. If you take a look at the next source, yes, it is. And actually, in the context in which it's presented, this the Gemara where it's coming from, it's because there are sages who spend their whole day judging. And they're very upset. Either they're weak because they didn't eat, or they're upset because they didn't get to do their own learning. And so they are addressed by another sage who says to them, you didn't need to spend all day judging. You don't need such long hours. Even if you do it just for an hour, you are already a partner with God in creation. You didn't have to sit there. And even Moshe, they argue, didn't do it all day long. And that's its own discussion. I just didn't want to get drawn into that, which I just did. But source number 7... the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Kol Dayan Shadan Din Emet La'amito, every judge, again, that phrase, who judges truthfully, Mashresh Shechina B'Yisrael, causes Hashem to be manifest among the Jewish people. And then the reverse, Kol Dayan She'eino Dan Din Emet La'amito, if he does not judge truthfully, Gorim L'Shechina She'tiselek M'Yisrael, he causes God to leave the Jewish people. So that this is a religious obligation. And therefore, I can't outsource it. If I take my judgments and bring them to a secular court, I am now skipping the system which is meant to bring God among us. I'm skipping a religious obligation and going to their courts instead. And there's much more to say about this, but there's more we need to get to. If you look at all the Nevi'im, the prophets, they criticize corrupt justice right alongside idolatry to say that justice is a religious obligation like worship of God. So, those are our three arguments for why we don't go to a secular court. Number one, it desecrates God's name. It's a rejection of Torah itself. Number two, because you run the risk of destroying ours, because people aren't going to want to study ours if we don't use it, and they won't study it in the same way. And number three, because justice is a religious responsibility. Now, going back to our question then, what if the judge is Jewish? And it's a non-Jewish court system, what would you say based on these three reasons? If I take... Right, he still won't study our system, right? And it's still a rejection of our system.
It's worse.
It's even worse. The Chazon Ish says that, as does David. Rosh HaKivanta. The Chazon Ish, writing in his work on Sanhedrin, in Tetzvah there, he says, it's actually even worse, because that means that not only have you abandoned our system, but the judge has also abandoned our system. He says, I could have learned Torah and become a Jewish judge and a Jewish Beit Din, and instead I decided to go with a secular system. So under that, also, the Jewish judge doesn't make it any better. The question, though, will become, I'll address it here, I was going to do it at the end, but I'll address it now. What about arbitration? Is arbitration or settlement the same thing? I think the answer is no. And I'm not the only one to say that. Rabbi Michael Broyd makes this point in the book that I mentioned earlier, The Chazon Ish, as well, that when you're dealing with somebody who is not going to use a different system of law, he's simply going to talk to the parties and come up with an agreement which is manageable for both sides, which both sides can accept. So he's not, by going to this arbitrator who is not bound by any particular system, you're not rejecting Torah law in favor of some other system. So that is not a concern. you're not causing Torah to be forgotten, assuming this is a one-shot deal. There, it's, I think, a little more fuzzy. Because if people keep doing this, eventually it will, in fact, lead to the rejection of the Torah's system. And as far as connecting to God and building up the world in this image of Torah that comes with Jewish justice, so certainly you can make that argument, and that, in fact, is a whole debate in the Gemara in Sanhedrin as to whether a Jewish court that decides we're going to compromise, we're going to arrange compromise, are they abdicating responsibility? Or are they performing their greatest responsibility by bringing peace between parties? And so that's a debate in its own right. Is it good to try to pursue a settlement? Dory.
Isn't, on a philosophical level, the fact that the courts are aligned with religion sort of puts the idea that religious people will then take preference over non-religious people, and that's why Jews, in some cases, prefer to go to secular courts, in that it sort of, it's a system where everyone is, quote-unquote, on a philosophical level,
equal in the eyes of the law.
That's right.
Right, so this is a big, big problem. There definitely is a sense of they're going to go with their own. And let me make it even worse before I make it better. There's also a sense, and I think it's come from certain specific cases, and then a whole lot of prejudices, that women will not be treated the same way as men in the eyes of these courts.
Right.
And that's a terrible problem. It's a busha. It's a real shame for us that there could be such a perception out there. And without going too far afield on this point, I think it's the responsibility of the community. It's a responsibility of those who are members of the observant community that creates these courts to make sure that there are no such prejudices and that that's conveyed to the world beyond. And it's a responsibility of others beyond that they not look upon this with a prejudice, that they, you know, give it a fair shot. I mean, it's true. I had a particular case of get. The religious bill of divorce. But a woman told me she doesn't want to go before the Beit Din to receive a get because she's heard that the judges spit at her. I don't know where she got this. I don't know who told her this or whatever. Unfortunately, I was involved in various arrangements of bills of divorce over my years in the rabbinate. I never saw any such thing, never heard of any such thing happening, but there are all these stories. I thought maybe from Chalitza, but even in a Chalitza case, there are no judges spitting at the person.
But
it's entirely reversed. I don't want to go into Chalitza, but... Sorry? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But that's what people will say, and it's terribly, terribly damaging. One more point within this. If you take a look at source number 9, Mishnah in Sanhedrin, core text in Jewish law says, Omar lo, what if one litigant says to the other, Ne'eman alai abba, I accept my father as a judge. Technically, relatives cannot judge. I accept my father as credible. Ne'eman alai avicha, I accept your father as credible. Ne'emanim alai shlosha ro'ei bakar, 3 random shepherds, I'll take them as my judges. Rabbi Meir Omer yochol lachzor bo, Rabbi Meir says, if he wants to recant, he can recant. Although they are valid, he can choose to back out of that if he wishes. The sages say, no, he can't recant. He may not back out. Once you accept them, that is binding. So the question then is, if I'm able to accept 3 shepherds, random shepherds, right? Why am I not able to accept the secular judges? Why shouldn't that be okay? So Ramban, Nachmanides, writes about this in source number 10.
Three
Jewish shepherds, yes. So if you take a look at source number 10, you find Ramban Nachmanides writes, even though the sages listed these 2 groups together, and what he's talking about is back in source number 1, when we said, don't place your judgments before them, before idolaters, or before people who are ignorant, so it sounds like they have the same status. And now you're telling me you can accept ignorant people, so maybe I should be able to accept judges. He says, they're mentioned together, but yesh hefresh b'neihem, there is a difference between them. Shimratzu shnei balei adin lavo lefnei ha'edot sheb'Yisrael mutarhu. Should the 2 litigants wish to come before a regular Jew, uneducated, that will be permitted. Ubedikivlum alei lavayu dino din. And if they accept him, whatever he says is the law. Aval lifnei agoyim asurim heim lavo lefanav. But in front of the nations, that is prohibited. Sheyidon lahem b'dinehem leolam, for him to judge, for them to judge according to their laws. So Ramban says, no, it doesn't work that way. And in fact, that's the way we rule, that you're still not able to accept them. Why not? Let's go back to our three reasons. If our concern is strengthening idolatry, right, then even though I can accept ignorant Jews, I can't accept those who are from the nations who are going to judge according to their system of law. That's not going to be acceptable for me. If I'm concerned about nullifying our laws, then I don't want to accept them. Frankly, I don't want to accept the shepherds either. Within the idea of building up a world in an image of Torah, right, this religious obligation of justice, so by accepting the non-Jews in their system, I am now making that worse. It's even worse than the three shepherds. Because with the three shepherds, everybody knows they're just doing whatever comes to their mind. If I go to the non-Jewish system, it's much stronger. It's strengthening the system that they create.
It's curious that they pick shepherds.
Because we have so many learned shepherds and pious shepherds in our history.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's true. It's a very interesting point. The choice of shepherds is interesting. Agreed. Okay. So this everything we've said addresses the first question I mentioned in the beginning. Why is it that we're against litigating in secular courts? Now we have to get to the second question, which is, what do I do if I'm stuck? What if the other party has no interest whatsoever in going to Beit Din? Maybe they're Jewish and they've heard that they're not going to get a fair shake. Maybe they're not Jewish at all. So now what? So, number one, where a Jew is sued in secular court, it is agreed by halakhic authorities that you go. You don't say to the secular court, sorry, I don't respect your system lots of luck. The rule has been cited down through the generations. Rabbi Badi Yosef has a response among this, is that you go. But what about where you're the plaintiff? You want to sue somebody, and you would like to use the Jewish court, but they're not interested. So if you take a look at source number 11, he's building this off of a passage in the Talmud, but he's going to quote it, so I didn't bring the Talmudic passage separately. It's Bava Kamma, not Tzadipet. Menach HaMilta, this is Rabbeinu Asher. Rabbeinu Asher is fascinating himself for the fact that he bridged two societies. He starts out, as I wrote on the sheet, in 13th century Germany, and then he has to flee Germany, and he goes to Spain in the early 14th century, so that he crosses Ashkenaz and Svard at a pivotal period in the history of the two. This is his response, and I don't know whether it was written before or after his flight. Actually, it's not a response. He actually writes this in his commentary to the Talmud. Menach HaMilta da'amri inshi karit l'chavra chaloanyach rami guda v'shadi ilave. This is a quote from the Talmud. The Talmud says, what is the source for this statement that people make? They say, if you summon your friend and he doesn't answer, knock down the wall on top of him. Right? Meaning, you called him, he didn't respond, do whatever it takes to get him. Where does that come from? Dichsiv, they quote a sentence in Yechezkel, Dichsiv yan tihartich v'lo tihart v'lo tahart. Loti Tari Od. Mitumasech is my own interpolation. That appears in the original pasuk, but Rabbeinu Asher did not quote it. He says, God says, since I purified you, I tried to, and you didn't accept it, you didn't become pure, therefore you will not be purified again. So in other words, you gave it a good shot. You tried to bring him to Beit Din, you didn't succeed, now you do what's necessary. And so he says, Mikan Pasakra Paltai Zal, that letter of Paltai Gaon, writing, I believe, 9th century, he ruled, Reuven Sheishal Tvial Shimon. When Reuven has a claim from Shimon, Umisarev Lavo, and Shimon refuses to go, Lavo Moladin, Shemashaila Havio Ler Kaot Shal Nochrim. At that point, you can bring him to the non Jewish court, Kadela Hotzi at Shalomi Tachat Yado, in order to get your property back from him. You are not responsible to commit suicide in order to honor this law. You don't have to give up on your property. You did the right thing. You did not succeed. Now you do what you need to do in order to protect your own. That's one source. Second source is in source number 12. Source number 12 is a Gemara in Bava Kamma. I'm going to stay it outside because we're already hitting the 40-minute mark soon. The Gemara is a great story, though. You should read it. There was a shared well where the partners were each supposed to take water on a certain day and water their fields. So one guy starts taking water and irrigating his field on someone else's day. The other fellow shows up and sees it, and he says, it's not just random that we say each one gets a day. There isn't that much water coming out of this spring. We need the water. If he takes the water, my field is going to dry up. My plants are going to die. And so he says, stop. And the other guy doesn't listen. So he takes a shovel and he whacks him over the head. The other guy takes him to court. Right? This is not what we call proportional response. The judge says he can hit him 100 times if he wants. If that's what it takes to get you to stop, let him hit you 100 times. Why? Even though we do not generally believe, oh, there's a debate about extrajudicial action of an inish dina l'nafshe, for a person to be a vigilante and say, I'm going to take law into my own hands. Nonetheless, to prevent loss, immediate loss, where if you wait to go to court, your crops are going to die, you take justice into your own hands, and you can do it right then. And that is the second source that is quoted. Ramban Nachmanides in source 13 quotes this as the basis for going to a secular court. There's a significant difference between the two. Because in the first case, we said, you first tried nicely. Well, I guess here, no. In the second case, you also tried nicely. You did say stop before you hit him over the head. You did try. And so, you are allowed to do this, to go to the secular court in order to get your property back. Some ask a very interesting question. There's a work called Kli Chemda on the Torah that asks, this rule that we don't go to secular courts is a prohibition. If you know your system of Jewish law, you're aware that in order to keep myself from violating a prohibition, I am obligated to spend all of my money. That's the rule. If it's a choice between eating non-kosher food and eating kosher food, and eating kosher food is going to cost me 100 times as much, I'm still responsible to eat the kosher food. So how is it that you can say, well, so that you don't lose your assets, you can go to the secular court, violating a prohibition? So by Krauss, in the article I mentioned, suggests that it's because our whole concern was that you display rejection of the Torah system of law, canceling the study of Torah and all that. By trying to go to the Jewish court first, you satisfy that. It's very clear to all the onlookers that you tried, and therefore you're not in violation of the principle at all. You acted in good faith. This is brought as halacha, as law. If you go back to the beginning of your sheets, source number 2, this is the second half of that quote from Maimonides. He says, Haisayat after the ellipsis. Haisayata akum takifa. If the hand of the nations was strong, Ubal dino ilim, and the opponent, the opposing litigant, is powerful, ve'eno yacholo tzimimenu b'dayanei Yisrael, and he's not able to get anything from him in Jewish courts, yit be'enu l'dayanei Yisrael t'chila, first go to the Jewish court and make the claim, im l'ratzel avot, he doesn't want to go, notel reshus mi beis din, then get permission from the court, umatzil b'dinei akum miyad bal dino, and then go to the secular court in order to get what you need from him. And this is brought in the Shulchan Aruch as well. Now, the truth of the matter is, and this is the last point that I want to get to, the procedure for this is subject to some debate. Because we still try to strike a balance between defending the Torah's system of justice, on the one hand, and saying, use Jewish courts, and then on the other hand, making the situation tenable, helping you to be able to survive economically. So that, if you take a look on your sheets at source number, the third side, source number 14, Rav Chaim Ben Venisti, writing in the Knesset Hagadolah. And here I'm going to go a little quicker, so you can look at it inside. But he discusses the case, and he says, let me read this one out, I'll sum up the other ones. He says, I saw in the rush, and he quotes what we've already seen, he says, from the rush, it sounds like you can just go straight to the secular court. You don't need to get permission from the Jewish court. There's no need for a document saying he tried his best, which is against the position of Rashi Ragon, the Rambam, Maimonides, the Mordechai. So he suggests a distinction. He says it could be that if you're saving your property from the other guy, he's holding your stuff, that doesn't require permission from the court. But if you want to get paid back, reimbursed for something, he doesn't hold your property. He owes you money. Then in that case, and maybe there you need permission from the court. Because where he has your property, it's like the well. If you don't get it now, you're going to have a problem. So there, you can act immediately. But otherwise, you need to resort to the court. That's one suggestion he makes. Alternatively, he says, it depends on how powerful this person is. It could be that you don't need permission from the courts, is his second suggestion, if the other guy is powerful. That's where you don't need to... that's where you do need permission from the court. You need permission from the court if you're dealing with a powerful party specifically. And the reason for that is twofold. Number one, this powerful person, we mean a guy who never goes along with anything. So if you are going to try to push him to court, he's going to refuse automatically. He doesn't even think twice. He just states a refusal, and that's not real refusal, not until he goes before a Beit Din. And number two, because it's not always wise to take powerful people to court. When you do that, you're going to take him to the secular court. You may create all sorts of problems. You're creating precedents that he's going to use to his advantage. And so therefore, we're not so comfortable with the idea that you're going to go to a secular court with this fellow. And therefore, we want you to go before the Jewish court. They're going to evaluate whether this is a good idea. And that's what he suggests. That maybe if you're dealing with someone who is powerful, maybe there you need a Jewish court, but otherwise, you do not. Most authorities do require, in practice, an actual decision of the Beit Din to permit. And going back to Rav Shrira Gaon, writing in the 10th century, they went even further. In Source 15, Rav Shrira Gaon says that the practice in his community in Babylon was that they would actually make public announcements in the synagogue three times to make sure everybody would know what this person is doing as an attempt to convince him that he should go to the Jewish court. It was public shaming, essentially. They would warn him of what's going to happen to him, that he's violating the law, and really get involved actively. Some even require, and this is the most extreme position, that the court, the Jewish court, evaluate the merits of the claim. So in other words, they will only refer you to the secular court in the event that they evaluate your claim first and find it to be merit, to have merit. Then they'll send you to the secular court, but otherwise they won't. So if you take a look at the last source I brought, source number 16, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, the rabbi in Novardok in the beginning of the 20th century, he says that in the case in which the court knows your case has merit, your argument has merit, they can send you to the secular court. If they're not sure, and there's no other recourse besides the secular court, then they should actually call a hearing, hear your evidence, try to decide as best they can, although they know they're only hearing one side, and if it appears that it has merit, then they give you a writ, they give you a document saying you can go to the secular court. But otherwise, they wouldn't do so. You see that we're walking a tightrope here between two sides, wanting to strengthen the idea of supporting our Torah law and our Beit Din system, and then on the other hand, keeping a functioning economy. And it's a very tricky balance. And so the courts have had to figure out how to create a procedure that will not be too onerous, but on the other hand, will protect our courts. I did mention I was going to address one other case. What about where the defendant isn't Jewish? You're suing someone who is not Jewish. So some authorities do still require that you get permission from a Beit Din to go to a secular court because of the honor of our court system. While others say, no, you're dealing with someone who isn't Jewish, it's understood he's not interested in going to a Jewish court. And therefore, you do get to pass go effectively without getting permission. This is subject to some debate. But again, to sum up, we noted the prohibition already going back to the Talmud against going to the secular court. We suggested that even though they have a mitzvah of setting up courts, and we are told we must obey the law of the government, nonetheless, we have three reasons to want to handle the case in our court system. Number one, because it looks terrible for the Jewish courts when you go outside our system. Number two, you run the risk of destroying our system by supporting the other one. And number three, because justice is a religious obligation for the Jew. And therefore, because of all three, even though I can accept an uneducated judge, I can't accept a judge from another system. What if I can't get the other litigant to court? So then the rule is, that I am able to take him to secular court. However, I need to get permission from a Jewish court in certain cases, and it's subject to debate as to what extent the court is going to give that, whether they need to investigate first, and so on. But that's the summary, the 30-second summary for those who fell asleep while watching the video. So, thank you very much. As always, I hope to follow up by email, so please do send me questions that you have, and we'll try to discuss that way. The audio should be online on YU Torah, the video on koshertube.com. God willing, next week here, we will have the third of our four parts, and that is the issue of rent control, the ethics of rent control, so please be here. Thank you, and thank you again to Steve for setting this up.